just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises.
Paul Simon had his first trip to the Billboard charts in 1957 as part of what was then called Tom and Jerry, along with partner Art Garfunkel, went on to score a ton of hits like The Boxer, and then has continued to have a remarkable solo career for more than four decades. He's in the midst of what he says is his farewell tour right now. Simon's life and his artistry captured wonderfully in a brilliant new book by our next guest. The book is called Paul Simon, The Life, The Author. Longtime Los Angeles Times music critic, the author of Johnny Cash, The Life, Robert Hilburn joins us this afternoon. Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Rich. How are you? You think this will be his last tour? You think he'll be like the Eagles and Cher?
Well, I was going to ask you that because you know him awfully well. I can't see a time when he'll stop making music, but do you think we'll ever see him? I'm sure he'll make individual appearances here and there, but will he ever go out and play a series of venues like he's doing now?
Yes, you're right. He's not retiring in the sense of not. He might write more songs. He might make another album, but this is it. This is it for formal touring. He might do a show someday, let's say in New York or some other city, for as a benefit for something. But no more tours like this. And I was with him on his last tour before this in England. It was coming to an end, and listening to him talk, it was just like listening to the guy who wrote Homeward Bound. He was tired of it. You know, he wanted to do other things in his life. I think as much as anything, spend more time with his family. Being a songwriter at a high level like that takes a lot of sacrifice. And for a lot of years, Paul put all his energy and emotion into songwriting. But since Graceland, he's become a warmer person, I think, wanting to have more balance in his life, seeing his family. And this is the culmination of that.
Now, you've known Paul Simon for many, many years. A lot of people have written about him. This is the first time that he's cooperated in that effort. You had over 100 hours of interviews with him. What was the hook to get him to be a part of this project?
Well, I think he just finally felt it. I mean, it took me a long time to talk him into it. He didn't jump at the chance because he had turned down so many chances to do this, or at least people to, you know, do interviews for this. And I said, Paul, if you don't do a book, people are going to keep doing books about you. It's going to have false things in it. You ought to do a book that you explain your life as fully as you can and talk about your songwriting. That was the thing I really tried to impress on him. Let's talk about your artistry, how it comes about. Let's talk about some of these songs. And he was much more interested, Rich, talking about the songs. He felt more comfortable than talking about himself. And it took a long time to get him to open up to where he talked as eloquently about his personal life as he did the songs, but he finally did it. And I was really delighted when he did speak so eloquently about both sides of his life.
You were able to get him to give you a complete creative control on this, but I understand that almost came apart on the issue of your desire to talk with his girlfriend in England back in the 60s, Kathy Chitty.
Well, yes, that was an important thing. Some people have been suspicious, especially music writers. If you talk to somebody for that long, you know, it originally was going to be 60 hours, it went up to 100 hours, you're going to sacrifice some objectivity. But I was an experienced reporter before I was ever a music critic, and I knew how to separate the two. I'm not saying there's something in the book somewhere that might give Paul's side more than a person might normally do, but I think it's very little, because I wanted to present an objective book, and he did too. And early on, I was nervous, though, because I didn't know whether he would change his mind, and because he was known as kind of a control freak in the recording studio. So we were going to London, and he said, here are some people, Bob, you ought to talk to. Some of these people aren't going to like me, but you ought to talk to them because they know my story there. And he said, but one person is off limits. That's Kathy Chitty, who was his first love. He wrote Homeward Bound about her. He wrote Kathy's song about her. And she's never talked to anybody about their relationship. And Paul has never talked about the relationship either. And I sent a note back to him saying, Paul, I understand your feelings about Kathy, but nobody can be off limits. If I can find her, I'm not saying you have to help me find her, but if I find her and talk to her and she wants to talk, it has to be in the book. Otherwise, it's going to be compromised. And I waited about, a minute or so because I was sending that in an email, and I got back which two words, I understand. And from then on, I was really relieved that he was going to be, he lived up to his word of not trying to control the content.
We're talking with Robert Hilburn here on Downtown. And Bob, the book is fantastic, but to me, and the biographical information is great and shed some light, but what really makes this book stand out to me is the insight it provides into the creative process of one of the great songwriters of all time in popular music.
Yeah, that was my sub-theme, Rich. When I decided to write a book about after Johnny Cash, my favorite topic probably, or my favorite aspect of music as when I was a music critic was songwriting. And I once did an interview with Bob Dylan that lasted 9 hours, if you can believe it, in Amsterdam, where we weren't, I said, Bob, we're not talking about your personal life at all. Just tell me about how you write songs. And that was kind of an inspiration for doing this book. Who could I do a book with talking about songwriting as someone who was at the highest level for the longest period of time? And no one has written as high quality songs as long as Paul Simon did. You can take his work from the 2000s, a song like Questions for the Angels, and it really stands up to his best work. So that was my goal, getting to explain how you write a song, how artistry comes about, and that's a very complicated process, and then, equally important, how you protect that artistry against distractions, such as fame, which can be can destroy artistry, wealth, divorce, drugs, fear of failure, all those things that contribute to limiting artists from being productive for a number of years. But Simon resisted all of that and continued to be productive.
His songs, as he says in the book, often start with rhythm, often start with a sound, and that leads to a feeling. And then quite often the story of the song develops on its own or at least out of the ether, and he can't always pinpoint where that inspiration comes from.
Yeah, that's the key thing. You know, if I wrote a song, if you and I wrote, sat down and said, let's write a song, I think the first question we'd ask each other is, well, what's it going to be about? You know, what do you want to write about? Heartbreak? We want about happy days, going to the bar at night, traveling somewhere. But he doesn't do that. He sits and plays on guitar or piano notes. And at some point, those notes will strike him as evocative. Then he says, okay, what am I saying in those notes? How can I say in words what I'm feeling? And then he takes it one line at a time, and he discovers the theme as he goes through. And in the book, he talks about Sound of Silence. He didn't know what he was writing about when he started that song. Graceland, he didn't know what he was writing about, but it comes to him in the middle of the song or at some point in the song, and that's it's just his subconscious is what's working, and he feels you can get better ideas from your subconscious than you can by sitting down and planning, oh, okay, I'm going to write a song about this, because that limits your imagination in the song.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting that Kodachrome, originally the words that fit that melody, were going home. And even something as simple as the choice of which guitar to write about in Graceland, I think it was three tries before he settled on National Guitar because of the double meaning.
Yeah, the impressive thing, the hard thing to do when you're writing a book about someone like this, Rich, is not to be too flattering, not to be too awed by him, because these are great artists. We're talking about, you know, like Lennon McCartney or Dylan or Springsteen or someone like that. They're great artists, Bono, and you're in their presence, and they really think about these things much more than you ever imagine they do. And you know, picking the individual words that they use in a song and using National Guitar to have a sense of national unity, and also there is a National Guitar, and he uses that sound in the record. So it's being so specific. He could have said just any old guitar, and a listener wouldn't have cared, but he makes it so much better by finding just the right word.
I think my favorite story about the song creation was one of my favorite songs and one of his recent tunes, Darling Lorraine, and how he himself was surprised when he realized the fate of Lorraine as the song developed.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, the funny thing is, when I started writing the book, Paul, again, always wanted to talk about the songs. Let's talk about the songs. And he'd get very complicated, and I'm not a musician. I can't read notes. And he would start using notes and stuff, and I kind of resisted that. And back in the times, I would always try to avoid being too complicated so a listener wouldn't understand. But as we spent more and more and more time talking about the songs, I gradually, as the book goes, let him get more and more complicated, because I think the reader gets hooked early on about his songwriting, and I think even if they don't know notes he's talking about, they can see the complexity of what he's talking about. And I love Darling Lorraine. That's one of the things that he's doing an album now that'll probably come out in the fall, where he takes 10 or 11 of his old songs that were not hits, and he redoes them. And it's because he wants to give them a different, a second chance at being heard. And that's one of them, Darling Lorraine. And I just love that song. But, you know, sometimes songs are pop hits, Richard. They're just Kodachrome, just can't miss. But Darling Lorraine's a little more complicated than that. It's not, it doesn't jump out at you. You don't sit in a jukebox, probably put a nickel or a dime or a quarter or whatever it is today, to hear that song. But it's such a beautiful song. And it's certainly not one of my 10 favorite Paul Simon songs. And that'll be on that album.
As you point out in the book, Bob, he struggled a long time trying to make it as a songwriter after the initial success of Hey Schoolgirl. How much was learning about the business and learning about music and learning a work ethic from his father, Lou, how did that enable him to not only become successful, but maybe lead to what he's doing today? And the fact that, as you point out, he's almost unique among his peers to still be coming up with top flight material after 6+ decades.
Yeah, the New Yorker had an interesting essay 2 or 3 years ago saying that he, of all the songwriters from the 60s and early 70s, he's the one who's doing the best work in the 2000s. And his father, the lesson he got from his father, who was a bass player, but not a very successful one, he had a band and they played bar mitzvahs and a few television shows, but not a big star by any means, kept saying, "Paul, you never master the music. Respect the music. You've got to keep getting better. You can never settle." And that's the lesson he learned. That's the reason he left Simon & Garfunkel. He was tired in 1970 of writing that kind of song. He only knew 3 chords. He wanted to learn more about classical music and jazz and Latin music. And he knew he had to leave Garfunkel if he was going to maximize his potential as an artist. And look where he went. I mean, Me and Julio, Graceland, those songs were not Simon & Garfunkel songs. And if he had limited himself to Simon & Garfunkel, I think he would have been burned out by the end of the 70s.
You examine the relationship with Garfunkel that goes back to, the, I think, 6th grade when they first encountered each other in a school play, one in which Garfunkel didn't even sing, and Paul had the lead. But it's been a remarkable relationship. Like anybody who'd been friends with someone for all those years, when they reunited in 03, you talked about the genuine affection that was there, but now they haven't spoken in a while. Does Paul Simon understand the public's desire to see them get along and perform together?
Oh, yes, he does. And he, you know, they're further apart now, Rich, than they ever were in terms of working together or friendship or all that. Just total separation. But Paul spends some nights talking about how wonderful it was back in those days and how much fun they had. And he'll say nice things about what art contributed to this record or not. So there's one side of him that it's almost like brothers in a way. It's one side that really has affection for art, but there's the other side that knows creatively they just can't coexist.
And I love the story that he told about the two of them sitting in a car and hearing their music on the radio for the first time.
Yeah, it's like they had the number one record in the country. They were sitting in a car somewhere in Queens, and Paul or Art says, "Boy, I bet you they're having a lot of fun tonight." And they just didn't know what to do. They were just overwhelmed by all this success because Paul had been working for so long to have a hit record. And the thing about was one of the most fascinating things to me, I guess, is that Paul was not a natural-born songwriter. You think anybody who writes all these songs had to be playing the piano at 3 and writing lyrics at 6 and stuff. But he after the breakup of Tom and Jerry, which made that record Hey Schoolgirl, which was a copy of an Everly Brothers song, he spent 5 years in recording studios, writing songs, trying to get a hit record, and none of it was any good. You know, it's just amazing. He learned a lot about recording. He learned a lot about the record business, but the songwriting was terrible because he was just copying teen pop songs on the radio until he heard folk music and Dylan. That changed him. He wanted to write deeper songs. And when he had broken up with Garfunkel after Tom and Jerry, so when he went to Columbia Records, this was fascinating to me, he didn't go to get a contract for Simon & Garfunkel. He was going after a Paul Simon solo contract. And Tom Wilson, the record producer, said, "No, I'm sorry, son, we already have Bob Dylan. We already have a singer-songwriter. But if you know a group, it might work." And so he says, "Oh, I remember there's a friend of mine who I used to sing with. Let me bring him in." And that was the start of Simon & Garfunkel.
I thought it was very interesting, too, Bob, that you talked with Kathy Chitty, as we mentioned. You spoke with the late Carrie Fisher. You talked with Simon's first wife. And none of them really had a negative word to say about him.
But that's right. You know, that's one of the really interesting things. And it was kind of a hard thing to deal with in the book, because you don't want to look like you're taking Paul's side and fawning over it. You know, it's not like his book. It's, you know, it's a book about his life. But he had a reputation in the 60s and 70s for being kind of a prickly guy. Even when he first meets his first wife, she says to him, "I heard you weren't a very nice guy," because he was always fighting so hard to defend his music against record companies, anybody who wanted to change it. He had a vision, and also he worried that he was so short. He didn't think people took short people seriously, that they would override him. So he got a pretty belligerent attitude. But again, that started changing after Graceland. Graceland gave him so much confidence that made him a warmer person. He was easier to deal with. But dealing with that early prickly image was a difficult thing. But almost everybody I talked to, whether it was musicians, family members, Paul Simon is a good guy. He is a good guy. Now, there were people who don't like him because they met him during the 60s and 70s, and they thought he was blunt, he was rude, he was indifferent. But, you know, you talk to Dylan, Neil Young, any of those guys, if you get them when they're working on their music, they're not going to be the best of friends.
And he bounced back, first of all, from the disappointment of One Trick Pony to the Cape Man, his run at Broadway, and he's been able to persevere through that. How important has his marriage to Edie Brickell been to settle him down, to accept, I guess I would say, to accept himself?
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, you're really picking up, Richard, some good things in the book, the things I really think are important for people to know about Paul. Edie was a miracle for him, according to all the people I talked to. She didn't talk to me because she and Paul had a rule that their personal life was private. They were never going to open the door for People magazine to come in and take pictures of the family to promote an album. They saw how fame can destroy people, relationships and stuff. So I had to talk to other people about Edie. You know, friends, Lauren Michaels, Steve Martin, Paul's brother, Paul's best friend from grade school, and they all talk about how Edie brought something into his life, kind of almost common sense. She says, "Paul, don't worry about that so much. Think of this. Don't worry about that. Think of your blessings and stuff." And she made him lose some of that anger, or he rejects the word anger, but let's say apprehension that he carried for so many years.
Do you think at this point in his life, as he wraps up this farewell tour, that Paul Simon is at peace?
Is it what?
Is he at peace with himself?
Oh, yes, yes. I saw the show. He just played Los Angeles, and the music was what it always is. You know, he spends 2 hours a day on every show at a sound check, changing bits of the music, never satisfied, always keeps changing. So the music was excellent, as I thought it would be. But he was so warm on stage. He, in the past, he's been something of a stiff performer, kind of stands there, doesn't talk a lot to the audience. This time he was talking about a song, how he wrote it. He was telling a joke. He was just the look in his face. You know, he's at peace with himself. He's looking forward to the future. He's got a lot of gratitude.
Well, I saw him on the Rhythm of the Saints tour. I saw him again when he was touring with Brian Wilson several years ago, and I'm hoping to get to Boston and see him on the farewell tour on June 24th. A remarkable artist and a really remarkable book. Bob Hilburn, a fantastic job in telling the story, and for the first time really telling the story of the creation of this tremendous music.
Yeah, thanks very much, and I hope you do get to see him in Boston, because it'll be a different Paul Simon than you've ever seen before. Your heart will be warmed, not to be corny, but the fact that he came through all of this struggle, all the song The Boxer, all the struggle he had as a young man trying to get in the music business, trying to write meaningful songs and getting rejected, and he's come through all of that, and you can feel for him. You really do say, that's really nice if somebody can kind of win on his own terms.
Well, it's a wonderful book. And Bob, by the way, I loved the Johnny Cash book as well. It's a real treat for us to talk with you today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
That's Robert Hilburn. The book is called Paul Simon, The Life. And if you're a fan of Paul Simon, if you're a fan of music you got to read it. It's absolutely terrific.